Welcome in, everyone, to the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis. Have a very interesting show for you today, folks. This one is chock-a-block full of stuff that will tickle your brains. It will get your interest going. It has lots of good stuff in it. We're going to the world of Finland. I say world, it's a country, I know, folks. I don't want the emails saying, what are you talking about, Tim? World is a country. I can go there. I can get it on an airplane. I know you can. But we're going back into Finland's history, and we're going to talk a little bit about the occult tradition of Finland and some of the secrets there. We've got a book called Lightbringers of the North, Secrets of the Occult Tradition of Finland. It is co-written by, and I'm going to ask our guest to forgive me here, his co-writer is Perttu Häkkinen, and our guest, I'm going to bring him in now after I introduce him. Vesa Iitti is a Finnish writer and translator with a master's degree in comparative religion from the University of Turku. He lives in Turku, Finland, and I know I slaughtered that good, Vesa. Thank you so much for being with us here on Darkness Radio. How bad was my pronunciation there?
It was all understandable. It was great. Thank you, and it's an honor to be here.
And we should, just up front, we should explain to people before we begin the going through the book here that unfortunately your co-author here has passed away in 2018, so we want to pay proper respect to him. I'm sorry if I butchered. Is it Perttu?
Perttu. Yeah.
And I rolled my R too bad. I had too much Spanish when I was in school, so it's Perttu.
It's all good. Perttu Häkkinen.
Perttu. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Perttu, my apologies there. So, unfortunately, passed of a bike accident, I believe it was, correct?
Yes. Yeah. That was 2018.
Yes. Yeah. So, again, our condolences there. So we're going to start out slow here because there's a lot in this book. And when I say a lot, there's a lot here. And I think in America, we are woefully naive, we'll put it that way, of the traditions and older traditions of Europe and any traditions, rather when it comes to paranormal, supernatural, even of the occult. Is it safe to say that the traditions of the occult of Finland aren't necessarily that old?
Well, it depends what we mean, what kind of definition we give to those words. Like when it comes to esoteric, like scholars have been defining the word differently over time. And in a way, when you look at what's the bottom line, what esoteric or occult means, there's been something like that in every culture from the beginning of those cultures. But when it comes to like a Western occultism or esotericism, as it's roughly defined nowadays, we are a little bit, the history in Finland has maybe a little bit, we have a little bit less of that history. It's maybe shorter, but of course we have, when it comes to the pre-Christian spirituality and a kind of paganism, all of that, that's of course super rich, and we have a long time of that. And so, but it's a matter of definitions, like what do we mean by occult or esotericism. But when it comes to our book, we start roughly around the beginning of last century, around the time Finland got independent, 1917. Basically, we go a little bit further back than that, like from the very late 19th century or so. But your point that esoteric history in Finland might be a bit shorter than elsewhere, for example, in Central Europe, that's correct, because like so many other things in culture, also these things came to Finland a bit later than elsewhere, because we are at the edge of the world.
So, yeah, most definitely, but a very beautiful edge of the world at that. Tell us a little bit. We start out the book really kind of diving into, the concept of esotericism and what it is. And then we go into the beginnings of at that period of time Finnish esotericism and I guess, for lack of a better term, getting into who brings about the beginnings of, I don't want to say the occult, but the beginnings of magic in a way, or light bringing. Light bringing is a fair term, wouldn't you say, Vesa? At this point, we're talking about, is it, I'm going to butcher the name here. This is why I'm stalling. Is it Pekka Ervast?
Yeah, that's good. All recognizable. Yes, Pekka Ervast. You pronounced it pretty well.
Thank you. You flatter me.
Where should I begin? Do I speak about Ervast, or was there some other question that
I guess kind of lead us up to where Pekka enters the picture. With esotericism, kind of tell us how that forms and how Pekka comes into the picture.
Yeah, well, give a short tour just a short mention about the history of esotericism or occultism in Finland. Well, of course, like I said earlier, we have this rich pagan history tradition. All this folkloric material related to different beliefs of a spiritual world, how to do magic, and all of that is very, very rich. And we have a very rich, big archives of this folkloristic material in Finland. We are very lucky with that. Then when it comes to Western esotericism, as it's understood nowadays, inside the scholar circle or so, I would say that there were people who were doing alchemy and trying to practice alchemy and all of this kind of stuff. That was in the 17th, 18th century and so. Mm-hmm. And of course, Freemasonry came here quite early. That was suppressed during the time when we were independent part of Russia. We were under Russian Empire's rule from 1809 till 1917, when we became independent. That when Freemasonry was officially banned in Finland. There was 100-year break when it was all right publicly. And then when Finland became independent in 1917, it was all right again, that you can openly run these kind of things. And the traditional Freemasonry came back officially after that, and also L'Adroit Humane Freemasonry, that accepts both men and women as its members, that also became they started to operate here too, in the early part of last century. Early part of last century, there's of course that was a time when all these kind of alternative spiritual views were bubbling in general in Europe and in the States. Of course, things like a theosophical society, mm-hmm. and things that came from there, spiritualism, all of that arrived here too, but with a little bit delay, so to say, because we didn't have internet back then, and so right. Things came a bit slowly, but they arrived here too. So basically the same things than else everywhere else, but a bit slower. And Pekka Ervast pops up in the story early last century. Ervast was born 1875. He died in 1934. He joined the Theosophical Society at very early age. He needed his parents' permission because he was underage still at that point, but he was very enthusiastic about theosophical ideas. And he was very important for theosophy in Finland. He was its founding members here, was at the head of the organization for a long time, and had a kind of important role also in the international field of theosophy. He was there kind of behind the curtains, a kind of diplomatic character during those times when there was these inner schisms inside Theosophical Society. And he also was important in bringing this Le Droit Humain Freemasonry to Finland, which also accepts women as its members. And when things went so bad that Ervast needed to resign from Theosophical Society, he founded his own organization, Ruusuristi, which translates into Rose Cross. And he was very important figure, of course, like in this kind of esoteric occult way for Finland, but he was also important cultural figure in general because, well, the society was changing, and like elsewhere in Europe, it was very common to have these discussions and opinions of criticism against like the established societal structure and official like Christianity and all of that. And he was there a kind of in between, like just the spiritual circles, occult world, and his other leg was, so to say, just in the regular society. He was very popular among people of the working class, and he was often invited to give speeches at their places, and so. And lots of people wanted to get him to promote like left-leaning politics, for which he felt sympathy towards, but he still all the time wanted to keep politics separate from spiritual pursuits, which were definitely the most important thing for him. He never like wasn't unclear about that which comes first. It was always spiritual practice, theosophy. Politics was something totally like a secondary or somewhere there. He didn't want to get involved with politics. But his sympathies were clearly more on the left side. And he was, like so many other people around that time, and a bit later, very much inspired by the national myth and Kalevala, the Finnish national epic, mm-hmm. that was very important, of course, for the Finnish like a feeling of independence and national identity in general. So he drew a lot of inspiration for that kind of folkloristic materials, not only from Kalevala, but these myths in general. Very important figure. And yeah, our book starts with a chapter on Ervast. Well, with a good reason.
Right. Very good reason. Let me circle back a little bit for a second here, Vesa, and ask you this question about Ervast. And that's this. Traditionally in Freemasonry, it's very much just men. What was the reason for inclusion by Ervast to bring in women to begin with? Why inclusionary, not exclusionary?
Well, I guess like the most traditional form of Freemasonry, this is for men only, as we know. And I guess this just comes with the times, like the culture back then, like let's say 200 years ago, like so many things were for men only. Like let's look at voting. Like Finland was among the first countries, if not the first in Europe, who gave the rights to vote for women too, and that was beginning of last century, like fairly soon after we became independent, but it wasn't like a very common back then. So lots of things were for men only. So traditional Freemasonry was for men only too, like men were in power, men were in important positions, women were at home and cooking and cleaning and keeping household stuff. So it just reflects the culture in general, how it was back then. But Ervast being a kind of a visionary spirit, I think he looked beyond these kind of things that are tied to time. He looked like that, that deep down we are all our spiritual beings, and we have our part in the work. This is how I understand his reasoning. Somebody who knows, like, is more deeply, like knows Theosophical Society and his history as part of Finnish theosophy might be able to elaborate on that. But I think it comes from this kind of general mindset that he had. He was very very much having this kind of equality and all of that. He was very visionary in many ways. Mm-hmm. In the early last century, for example, envisioned that the political reality where we are in Finland right now, it was very visionary that he saw that there's going to be Europe, a united Europe, a bit like United States, but a united Europe, like a European Union with one currency. That was something that I think not too many people were like saying that this is going to happen, but he saw it. And he also, among other things, he also predicted a few years before Finland became independent that Finland is going to be independent in 1917. So I guess he had an access to something where he got some things right about future.
That is visionary for that time. I mean, considering, you know, around that time, we're talking right around the time of World War One, there wasn't a lot of Europe that was thinking that way or thinking that, mm-hmm. you know, other than taking each other over by war, that everyone was going to get together and have a shared currency at least, or you know, or even sharing boundaries. I can't imagine that, you know, to think that people are going to get together and become that progressive was even close at that point.
Back then it was I think the common mindset was that we are Finns. We are a nation of our own. We are a country. We have our borders. We have our currency. We have our own legislation and government. And that's what we are all about. Like somebody saying that I'm looking forward to the future, where there are like not so strong national boundaries, and that we have a common currency in Europe. That was very much a minority.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing, especially for that time. Mm. That in itself is fascinating. The fact that Ervast was so forward thinking in multiple areas of not only just Freemasonry but of the world, to think that far ahead 100 years before his time, 100+ years before his time. How does Ervast change the game as far as, I hate to use it, I'll put it as saying light bringing. I hate to use the word magic. I hate to use the word the occult. Although it's in this book, I'll put it as magic. The world of magic. Put it that way. How does Ervast move things forward as far as Finnish magic?
Hmm. Well, he of course brought the theosophical ideas here, and this kind of thinking where you bring together East and West, and like so many others during that time, beginning of last century, which was very interesting time when it comes to this. These people tried to kind of validate their spiritual worldview by seeing how it matches with science, how these spiritual things can be explained by scientific theories. And so this was something new, like in the beginning of last century, maybe late 19th century. That was new because, of course, science was going forward. There was the Darwin's theory of evolution and the Freud's ideas, psychological ideas, all of these new exciting things that explained human behavior and human beings in new ways. And, of course, people who were into these alternative spiritual approaches. And so they needed to somehow make sense how this fits with our thinking and so on. There came this interesting synthesis of things, and Ervast of course was bringing this kind of mindset, like a theosophy itself, what was one of the main things that theosophy was drumming, was that we are looking to a truth behind all religions and all kind of worldviews, the thing that unites these all. So of course this includes kind of science too. And well, Ervast was bringing this kind of mindset here, and he was one of the first persons, I believe, who was writing and talking about yoga too. That was a totally new thing in the West too. So he was bringing new ideas, and that, of course, in a very deep kind of invisible way, affects the whole kind of current of occult thinking, magical thinking, like what does it contain, and so he kind of was creating the ground on which further, like coming generations and other practitioners like build on. So he was there bringing all these influences.
All right. You move on in the book. You talk about, you're going to have to forgive me about this. Is it George Ivanovich Gurdjieff?
We can just talk about Gurdjieff. Gurdjieff. That's good. Yeah.
American pronunciation again.
Oh, it's all good. All good. Yeah, we're talking about Gurdjieff. He was a Greek Armenian mystic teacher, very important figure in the beginning of last century, 20th century, absolutely huge in influence. And his influence carries still today. His ideas are very much appreciated and practiced. So the second chapter of the book tells a story of the Stjernwall family. They were a noble family, upper class people, very privileged, you could say, from today's point of view. Mm-hmm. And the Leonid, the father of the family, he was a doctor. He had his own practice. And they were living in a St. Petersburg area and so. And that's where they also met Gurdjieff. Gurdjieff had just started his group activities in Russia, Leonid Stjernwall happened to find these groups, and he became a very devout follower of Gurdjieff and his ideas. Kind of dragged his wife Elisaveta into the group too. She was not so enthusiastic, but appreciated the ideas anyway. And the chapter goes through their amazing adventures all the way from St. Petersburg through the whole exodus through Europe, finally settling in France, where the Institute for the Harmonious Development of Man was founded and where it operated till its very end. And this Stjernwalls had an amazing adventure through this whole thing, and they stayed there also till the very end of the group. So they were there, and there are interesting, of course, all kind of details about what happened during this exodus, during this tumultuous time in Europe in general. And then there is, of course, this thing about their son, Nikolai Stjernwall, whose biological father was none other than Gurdjieff.
Really?
For some reason, they weren't able to get a biological child themselves. So they asked if George Ivanovich could help, and he did. And they got the son, of which they were very happy about. And so he's there too. Later in the book, we also go into how is the Gurdjieff work in Finland nowadays and all of that. But this second chapter gives an idea and all kind of details and stories about these contemporaries of Gurdjieff, Finnish ones, like what they did, what they were involved with, and so it's a quite little known story. The insiders, so to say, know quite well some of these things, but in general, it's pretty much unknown stuff.
And Gurdjieff had dealings with Rasputin at one time as well, which is interesting.
He must have met him, because they both operated in St. Petersburg, Moscow area around the same time, beginning of last century. And the Stjernwalls too, as we go through in the book, they both met Rasputin and had very, very interesting encounters with him, he predicted, and Rasputin. Rasputin, Elisaveta, Leonid Stiernwald's wife, was worried that will they get child or not? And she wanted to ask this from Rasputin, who was, of course, known for his skills in telling the future. Mm-hmm. So she had a chance to meet the man, and Rasputin correctly told that, yes, you're going to get a boy. You're going to have a child. And wow, that happened.
Wow. Well, Vesa, I'll tell you what, let's take our break right here. When we come back, let's start to dive into some of the juicy stuff here, if you will. When we come back, we'll tease people a little bit and say, we'll introduce people to the darker side of the secrets of the occult tradition of Finland. We'll talk a little bit about how Satan makes his entry into the occult in Finland. We'll tease you with that when we get back. The book is Lightbringers of the North, Secrets of the Occult Tradition of Finland. I'm going to ask for your help again here, Vesa. Is it, it's Perttu Häkkinen?
Yeah, Perttu Häkkinen. Very good.
Perttu Häkkinen. Perttu Häkkinen. Vesa Iitti?
Yeah, Vesa Iitti.
Vesa Iitti.
You're doing all well.
I'm trying so hard here, Vesa. I'm sorry. I apologize.
No reason to apologize.
You're going to hear my Minnesota come out here because there's going to be a lot of sorry throughout the program. They're the authors of this fine book, and I encourage you right now to go to the link in the description of the show, pick up a copy. It's also available on audiobook, folks. There's an audiobook out there right now where you can also listen to the version of this book as well. It's highly entertaining, very informative, and lots of interesting, not only interesting stories, there's a few spooky stories in here as well you're going to want to read. So by all means, go ahead, check it out during the break. Lightbringers of the North, Secrets of the Occult Tradition in Finland. When we come back, we'll find out how Satan sneaks into Finland. That's coming up next on the Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis. Our guest is the co-author of Lightbringers of the North, Secrets of the Occult Tradition of Finland. He is co-author Vesa Iitti. Did I stick the landing?
It's all understandable. Vesa Iitti. Okay. Yeah, you did
Vesa
well.
Iitti. All right. I just have to remember to not be afraid to jump in and hit the pronunciation, right? Vesa Iitti.
That's good. Very good.
All right. And if I mess up, I mess up. There you go. Vesa, as I teased before the break, there comes a time where Satan has to rear his head. In magic, there's a light side, there's a dark side, obviously, right? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, so, that's true.
Yep. With everything, there has to be balance. There just has to be. Some people, I'm looking at this from a Western point of view, and maybe I'm wrong in this, and I want you to correct me if I am. But from a paranormal program, they would say, okay, well, there's a light side, there's a dark side. Satan has to jump in there, and Satan would maybe be the dark side for a paranormal program. But how does Satan jump into magic in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and specifically the magical side of Finland?
Well, that guy has been there for a long, long time. But when it comes to our book, I guess the first clear place where the devil is in the picture, that comes to the third chapter of the book that deals with this Tattarisuo magic circle. That circle operated in the early 1930s. There was this very, very kind of sinister case in Finland in 1930s. When they started to found body parts from this one well or spring in Tattarisu area, that's kind of Helsinki area, industrial area of Helsinki, they started to find body parts from that well, and it went out into the press, and it was a huge scandal. All the newspapers wrote about it, like, what is this about? Like, they found tons of these body parts from this well, and this is clearly doings of some cult. What kind of cult is it? Like, is it some upper class devil worshipping thing, or what is it? And that's the clear first part when the devil comes into the picture. It was seeing that there is some kind of really sinister practices involved. Well, it wasn't any upper class devil worshipping cult, but it was basically a 5-6 person group, very working class people, little education, who were trying to get a treasure from this well. That was totally their imagination. There wasn't any treasure in that well, but they tried to get that treasure that they believed was there to pop up to the surface by sacrificing or giving to this well body parts.
Really?
That of course never happened. Maybe they would have needed a few more body parts, I don't know, but so that was what they were doing. And in their these practices, they were using this grimoire called the sixth and the seventh book of Moses. In Finland, this is known mainly by name Musta Raamattu, which translates into the Black Bible. It gives much more sinister aura, reputation to the book than what it actually is when you look into its contents. It's quite boring book, actually.
Yeah.
but it was important for them and one of their inspirations. And this book had a very like a sinister reputation back then, and well, decades later too. Well, in addition to this magical treasure hunting, they were also having magical wars against right-leaning people of the country back then. And in the end, they were having magical wars pretty much against each other in the group. And they were channeling other worlds in very interesting ways, getting all kind of weird messages and stuff. This is what they were doing for a few years before this scandal took place and authorities found out who were behind it. And they got, in the end, relatively mild sentences, which tells that they were considered to be not in their full mental capacity. So they were not really fully responsible for what they did. But it was a bizarre case that really shook the nation and got also international attention. This is the first time that I could say devil enters into the picture of our story, of our book and its history. Later in the book, we come with other characters who were more clearly into devil worshipping or Satanism. Tattarisu, magic circle, people of this group, they didn't consider themselves to be doing any black magic or sinister activities at all. I think they thought that they were on a mission from higher powers, from God or so. They had a good intentions, mm-hmm. although their means were a bit questionable. But later, when we come to this character Pekka Siito and other persons and groups, then we are talking like Satanism. Devil pops up in the story in the 1930s or so.
Ah, I see. And we'll travel through that road a little bit as we go later, a little bit later into the program. I want to bring up the name. We talk about magic, we talk about clairvoyance as well, and we talk about the ability to see. I mean, you can scry. There's other ways to be able to see, psychic ability. You have a clairvoyant that you talk about in chapter 4. Is it Kassinen? Kassinen?
Kassinen. Aino Kassinen.
Aino Kassinen, right.
Yeah, very good.
Tell us a little bit about Kassinen as I trip over my words.
Well, Aino Kassinen, we call her in the book the clairvoyant of the nation. She was born 1900, died 1977. She was a basically self-taught helper. She was born in the very upper part of the country, moved from there first to Oulu, a little bit bigger city in north of Finland. Then eventually she came to Helsinki, the capital of the country. And on the way, she became very popular for her ability to help people in approaching all kind of troubles and questions in life. And she was able to predict future according to many and see what's like going to happen or what should be done. And so she became very famous, and all kind of people consulted her, asked her advice, like just from the ordinary people, like working class people, grandmothers, beauty queens, politicians, people in power in elsewhere in society, business, and so also like embassies of United States and Sweden, UK, the president of Finland, Risto Ryti, was also asking her advice and opinion at some point. So all kinds of people were really asking her opinion and help on many, many things. She was very unique in that, like that not before or after her anybody has kind of gained this kind of a status, that basically all kinds of people from all walks of life would like a turn for her and ask for an opinion. Well, after she passed away in 1977, there's of course been all kinds of people who have been willing to tell how things are going to turn out in world politics or wherever, but nobody has gained the status and the reputation like Kassinen did.
And what's amazing is she's a part of your history that if you're, and I mean, I'm not the oldest person in the world, but being in my early 50s, someone who you could remember. I mean, even people to this day can remember her part of living history. I mean, they've been around while she was around. So
right. Yeah. I don't remember. She died 1977. I myself was then just 5 years old. But I asked a funny thing. I just talked some time ago with my mother. Like, do you remember Aino Kassinen? Like, and she was, yeah, I do. Like, she was something.
Yeah.
People remember. She certainly made an impression.
Right. Well, like our parents' generation. I mean, it's like somebody listening to Elvis or somebody, you know, having that type of, that type of remembrance, yeah. You know, being able to go to a parent and saying, do you remember? You know, that's kind of a cool connection to history.
Right.
That's for sure.
Right.
I want to delve a little bit into some history here that's kind of interesting. I know we just got done talking a little bit about Satan, but there's an interesting character in your history that goes not only over Satan and black magic, but he also delves into UFOs and some Nazi areas too. And boy, you want to talk about a guy who's interesting. And I'm going to try to stick the landing here. Is it Pekka Sihtonen?
Yeah, all good. Pekka Sihtonen. Sihtonen, he was quite some character. He was born 1944, died 2003. He mixed politics and occultism in a way that I think maybe nobody else in Finland has. But Kassinen was his teacher in the beginning. And Aino Kassinen, who we talked just a moment ago, Kassinen was very much on the light side of things, like a very good, meaning, noble person. Sihtonen was too in the beginning of his occult interest in the late 60s, early 70s. But then around 1973, Sihtonen turned to the dark side and he started to write and publish books about black magic and devil worship. And at the same time, he also, publicly came out as a neo-Nazi. So like this, that's not the way to get friends.
No, not at all.
And he went 180 degrees on all possible ways. He said when it comes to politics, he said he was a Nazi. When it comes to religion, he said he's a devil worshipper. When it comes to sexual morality, he said that he's a debaucher, he's a pervert. He was in all of these things, 180 degrees, different from the mainstream Finn, like a very, very provocative person. In the early 70s, he founded his own occult organization, Turun Hengentieteen Seura, kind of a Turku Society of Spiritual Science, direct translation from the Finnish name. In the beginning, they were basically very much just influenced by theosophy and anthroposophy, and there was a mix of UFOs and all kind of things of the times that were very common in the early 70s in this kind of alternative spiritual circles in general. Then there started to be this political activism and this neo-Nazism involved more and more and blending with this spiritual side, and it all escalated into very scandalous things. They started to send letter bombs to leftist printing houses and organizations. And in the end, one member of his group, who was mentally very unstable, tried to explode this communist printing house in Helsinki, Kursiivi. Managed to set it on fire and cause huge damage, but the bomb didn't detonate anyway. It was such a huge thing that nothing like this had happened in Finland since the Second World War. And because of that, Siitonen and a few members of his society got prison sentences. After that, he continued with his political and spiritual or occult practices, but it changed in the way that it all became more like a one-man show and kind of a comedy. But he was he was something. He called himself like a Reichsführer, Valtakunnanjohtaja of Finland, and Archbishop of Lucifer.
Wow!
And his last wife told that when he was he had a throat cancer. When he was in his last months, weeks in the deathbed, he was still really believing in his spiritual ideas, that he was crying for help from Lucifer and all of this. And as a firm believer in reincarnation, he knew that in his next life, he's going to be born as the president of United States. So watch out.
yeah I somehow I don't doubt that he's coming down the line somewhere. The way we're going, I don't doubt it. We've had some interesting times here, so yeah, we're ready for him. I think what else could go wrong here, you know? There's an interesting point in the book where you talk about him, and he's talking about I'm trying to see where I can cut in here and talk about this, because you're talking about a sampling of associations from his odd dream interpretation manual, which even a child can use, and he's talking about he's associating different things with different things, and he draws these parallels which are just bizarre.
So, must be the most bizarre dream interpretation book that I have ever seen and that has ever been published in Finland. Could be anywhere in the world, but
I'll just give her some of it's not too PG that I can read over the air, but there's some things that just hit you right between the eyes. He called the country of Sweden baseless hopes. You need to think more. What? The guillotine, you will get in trouble. I think anytime you put your head in a guillotine, it's not a party, you know?
Yeah.
He said of Germany, you need to be more diligent to better succeed. So he had plans evidently for Germany if they wanted him on board.
He thought very highly of Germany, of course, and he meant like that if you see in your dream something dealing with Germany, it means that you personally need to be like more like Germany.
Yeah,
like
I guess.
That's the way to go with. And also his opinion of Sweden and of Russia, too, like all it reflected his views in a very funny way.
Evidently, if you dream of murder, you will defeat your adversary. Huh?
Yeah.
If you dream of a mummy, there's secret tasks that you need to. I've never dreamt of a mummy, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
In all my time. I mean, at least consciously remember dreaming.
Yeah.
I mean, just things like that. Okay, so there's the one here that I do have to mention. If you dream of a whipping, which I don't think I've ever dreamed of being whipped, you need to be active and hard.
Yeah.
You say this so casually, Vasily. Like, yeah. Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Sure. Just some bizarre thoughts. I mean, mm-hmm. So I have to ask this. At the time that he was espousing these values, was there psychological testing ever done on him to get deeper into the thoughts of the man to see if maybe there was some mental illness that came up or anything?
When he went to prison in the late 70s for this coercive arson thing, and they did, of course, psychological evaluation, and they put him in an intelligent test. And it turned out that he was clearly more intelligent than average person. His IQ was around 137 or something. Mm-hmm. So he, intelligent test-wise, he wasn't stupid. But when it comes to his personality, clearly he wasn't very balanced or... in a kind of a best possible state of mind. He had there was a good deal of narcissism and God knows what, but he wasn't a very balanced person. He was entertaining to look from beside, but I feel very sorry for his family members and anybody close enough. It must have been hell. I was living my youth in a city of Naantali, a very small city, around 10,000 people back then, and Sidon was living there too. So he was a talking point, definitely. Everybody knew him, and he was causing scenes here and there, and everybody knew that his family, his children and his wife, they all suffered because of his antics, what he was doing. So it was definitely tough for them. But when it comes to intelligence, he was more intelligent than average person, must have had several personality disorders. So no ordinary person stuff like that. I remember there was one psychologist or a psychiatrist who was interested in doing a kind of a psychological evaluation and a kind of a deeper picture of his personality at some point, because Sidon was so unusual character, how something like that can come out from our society. It was very odd. So there was somebody professional who wanted to figure it out and get a closer picture, but the story goes that he declined being evaluated in that way. So we don't know what the professional would have said in a deeper way.
I don't blame him, because to get inside the mind is to, I guess, divide and conquer the actual rationale of what it is you do. Does that make sense? So yeah. if he sits there and spills all to a psychiatrist, well, they can break apart what it is he believes in. and he's no longer the conduit to Satan, and he's no longer the conduit to his God that he, you know, he has his followers believing. You know, they break it apart and they come up with a scientific reason as to why he's come up with everything.
Yeah, they would emphasize some childhood traumas and whatever, all kind of things that kind of cause a person to develop in the way that he did and end up being like how he was. So, of course, that would not be good for a kind of aura and myth that he had around himself. So it's better to keep these things in the shadows.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, folks, just the chapter alone on him is it's well worth the price of the book. I'll tell you that much. There's one section about proper sex magic rituals and things to do, things not to do. That's worth the price of admission alone. He had his thoughts as to how you did your rituals and. Thank God for the two of you for putting that in there, because I'm sure it's like I said, it's the man was, if not anything, he was entertaining. That's for sure.
He was very, very entertaining. When it comes to his occult ideas, as I mentioned earlier, there was a good bunch of theosophy, anthroposophy, ideas of UFOs, and all these kind of popular occult ideas that were around in the early 70s. And so, but he was very creative, and in the end, he created his own mix of things. And when it comes to this, like these sex magic rites that you mentioned, and his idea of Satanism or devil worship in general, there's a good bunch of just his own creative and really funny comical ideas. It's wild stuff.
It is. Well, let me ask you before we move off of him here, Vesa. What was his theory? And tell our audience, what was his theory on UFOs and basically what he believed they were and where they came from?
Mm. In a nutshell, he thought that UFOs, they are they can be kind of like vehicles, like traveling machines for intelligent species from somewhere else from the universe, or that they are spiritual entities of some kind. And he, of course, had plenty of contact and involvement with the UFOs too, and these entities. His story begins with these early 70s. He told that he had a contact with aliens at his cottage at Vehma. He wrote a report of that, and he also provided a photograph of the case to validate his experience. And that photo was published in this UFO-Aika, UFO Age newspaper in the early 70s. And he claimed till the end of his life that this photo was real, and it has been studied and found out that it was genuine. However, I met this one man who ran this antique shop in Turku who had bought good bunch of Pekka stuff after he died. And from these archives, this man had found the original photo of this supposed UFO photo. In this UFO photo, there is basically two balls of light and some blurry things around. But this antique shop man told me that the original photo from which this published photo was blurred, the original photo was nothing else, nothing less than bare butt cheeks of Pekka himself. this is so great stuff that you need to applaud.
Now that's the best fake ever heard of. You gotta love that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, now when you know, I mean, I've heard of some good fakes out there, but that's a good one. That's a good one. Most definitely. That's how to end. That's how to end on a good note on a guy like that. That's for sure. Tell me a little bit about the beginnings of parapsychology in Finland. You know, one of the things that we love to tackle on this show is parapsychology and talking about the roots here in America. Of course, we had Hans Holzer And I guess you could say, really, he's the father of parapsychology in this country. I believe I can throw that his way, as well as paranormal investigation. He really came up with the idea of parapsychology here, I believe, in America. What were the beginnings there in Finland?
There's a whole chapter about parapsychology, its history in Finland, in our book. We basically go put in a nutshell everything, like a basic history, some very like prolific cases of poltergeist and stuff like that. These things started to interest people, surprise, surprise, in the beginning of last century, when these things started to be popular in Europe in general. These things came a bit late here, of course, because of geographical distance. But we have our own cases of like a poltergeist that were famous. Some of them really were well studied, and there were witnesses, and one case went to court, and because of that, it got quite a bit of international attention too. When it comes to organizations, or so the Swedish-speaking organization for parapsychology in Finland was founded in 1907. Finnish-speaking organization was founded a bit later in 1938. At that point, I need to tell that Finland is a bilingual country. We have both Swedish and Finnish as official languages. So that's why I mentioned those both organizations, the Swedish and Finnish language versions. And Pekka Ervast, who was mentioned earlier, he was again an important figure. He was having his part in the development of these organizations and their functions. So we go through the history of these organizations, who were running them, what kind of things they were involved with. And there were also a handful of academics involved. It was not only of interest to the layman, just kind of true believers, but there were also academic interests who were either total skeptics or kind of in between, like believing or not believing, who just wanted to look at more scientifically at the whole thing. So we go through some notable figures in the field, like Toivo Laakso, Sven Krohn, Reijo Vilenius, S. Albert Kivinen, and others like that, who gave kind of more really academic credentials for what was going on. There's also a good bunch of stories of different kind of important cultural figures, artists and others like that, who have told about their experiences and ideas of these things. So we go through all of that. Then there is a chapter of kind of sub-chapter in this parapsychology chapter. There's a chapter about Jarl Fahler, who was a parapsychologist. He was the head of the Swedish-speaking branch of this Parapsychological Society of Finland at one point. He was also an expert in hypnotism, and he studied LSD and mescaline in both Finland and United States in the 50s and 60s. So he was one of those who got these free samples from the Sandots.
Oh, wow.
Back then. And he found a very, very much a potential in that, in many ways for humans. And he also found interesting angles from this parapsychological and spiritual way to use these substances. And so when it comes to his worldview, he was clearly kind of having influences from Buddhism, and his general worldview was very much Gurdjieffian, if you will. Mm-hmm. This kind of idea that we are basically, humanity is most of the time kind of asleep. We are just reacting to stimulus response, and we are not fully present and awake. So he's one of my personal favorite characters in the book, and we go through what he wrote and did. Then, contrast to Fahler in this parapsychology field, there was a kind of a more showman characters like Olavi Hakasalo, He was born 1930, died 1988. He was self-taught hypnotist who was into occultism, parapsychological topics. He was very much showman, a little bit like Seaton, but not exactly as crazy. But he did some absolutely crazy stuff too. And there are reports that he healed people really with his skills in hypnotism.
And, really?
Yeah, there's some interesting cases with witnesses and so. So he had some skills, apparently, according to some persons. He was not just a showman. And he was into devil worship, of course, too, and wrote a book about magic and drugs. But it was so wild stuff by the 1970s standards in Finland that it got not published. And then there is the last sub-chapter in this parapsychology chapter is about Reimer Kampfmann, who died in 1992. He became very known after he published his book, Et ole yksin, You're Not Alone. It was a popular version of his doctoral dissertation, which was about side personas. It was a study about side personas. Many saw in Finland that the basic arguments of this book and his doctoral dissertation proved reincarnation. And there was lots of very interesting cases in his book. And we go in our book through these basic arguments and basic cases that he had. So this was of huge interest to people in Finland who were into parapsychology. And so back then that, hey, we have the smoking gun. Like this guy has like a scientifically, shown that these people can really like remember this kind of things and they can be put in this kind of mindset by this kind of techniques. And he has proven that. He himself didn't consider that his ideas proved reincarnation. He basically had a different kind of angle to the whole thing, but it was a big thing back then, and it still inspires people and gives food for thought. It's a very interesting stuff.
Jason, did he have a belief of if he had a belief of reincarnation? Obviously, he had a belief in past lives and where he had been previously. Did he have anything spectacular that he believed he had been in a past life?
Reimer Kampfmann himself, he didn't say, at least publicly, that he believed in these things. He didn't say any of these things. But these persons who he hypnotized and studied, they had all kind of memories of their past lives here and there, and they were very detailed about things, and it's amazing stuff psychologically. And also there were at least few cases where he himself, with his kind of skeptical scientific mindset, saw that one person who he was studying, she predicted some things and had seen a kind of UFO phenomena locally, and he was laughing at that. But then the next morning, when he was reading his morning newspaper with his cup of coffee, there was a report exactly like what this person had told him a day before, and all these kind of interesting things. So he witnessed something, although he was a bit more scientifically oriented himself.
Very interesting. Very interesting. So let me ask you this, Vesa, as you and your partner are going through and you're gathering this information, putting this wonderful book together, what hits you throughout the entire history of the Finnish occult tradition, and what resonates with you when it comes to these different traditions? What sticks with you as your favorite subject to delve into, or your favorite person to delve into?
Well, what comes first to mind is, and this is true of any country, any era, that the whole spectrum that a human interest, a quest for a spiritual truth inside of a deeper knowledge, a deeper reality. All of this, it really hit again, like that. This basic human quest for answers, basic questions of life and existence, meaning of life, all of this. This basic point, it can take so many different forms. It can be something like this Tattarisuo cult, this kind of primitive, odd magical practices where you go grave robbing and put body parts in the well in hopes of getting some spiritual insights and treasures, and to all the way more kind of a refined and noble and intellectual approaches like Gurdjieff's ideas and anything in between. There are UFOs, there's all kind of things, the whole spectrum that this human basic impulse or need to find answers to the reason why we are here, what we are all about. The whole spectrum, it's huge. And within different angles, there is a spectrum within a spectrum. There's people who are more showmen, who are more simple, and there's people who are more something to be taken seriously, who have something to really think about and consider. We are interesting species. We really like the richness of how we look for things, how we can do things. It's amazing. When it comes to my kind of favorite characters of the book, well, there are many that are interesting for different reasons, but when it comes to who I kind of, I would say that I respect the most, well, Ervast is there. Gurdjieff and Stjernwals, definitely. I've been looking into Gurdjieff's ideas for, you could say, like 2 decades or so. I definitely find that very interesting. Kassinen is a noble character too, and this Jar Fahler, who I mentioned when we were talking about parapsychology, his ideas and his kind of cultural criticism that he presented very harshly back then absolutely resonates with me. It's he has a very good, many valid points, and we present them in the book. And who else? Well, there are lots of interesting characters and groups, but I would say maybe those persons are my favorite when it comes to something that I can really respect and look high. Then there are Seaton, for example. As crazy as he was, he's interesting for other reason. He's all right, there are people like him too, sure, and he's entertaining and all of that. But when it comes to who I look up, who I have a special respect for, it's these guys: Ervas, Stjernwals, Gurdjieff, Kassinen, these people.
Right. Vesa, let me ask you this. As someone who has researched to the beginnings, come all the way to now, in the paranormal, in the occult, in magic, light bringing, even looked at different theologies. Who do you think is closer to having the meaning of life? The people that started out on this planet, or the people now? Who's got the better grasp on what the meaning of this whole thing is?
I don't know. I don't know. I think that's part of the fun, just the search itself. What do you think? I don't know. I have a resonance for certain people and their ideas more, but it is people are so different. Some things work for the others and not for me, and it can be that there are so many different as valid angles to the same question as there are people. So I don't know, what might interest me and be relevant to me might not be for somebody else. And so, but maybe the answer to this question is in the search itself and its energy somehow. Maybe there is not meant to be found some fixed final answers, that it's something living when it comes to experience inside us.
I guess my best answer has always been this, that although technology is great, we keep finding little nuggets along the way. There's the old saying, sometimes the old ways are the best ways. And we always keep going back to the old ways of the foundations that were set in order to come back to our roots, to reset, reevaluate, and move forward.
That's absolutely true. For example, if we look at the characters and ideas in our book, and basically in all occult books or related about these ideas, you can go all the way back to the basic ideas of Socrates, what Plato told in his dialogues. There is this analogy of people being in cave. Like our everyday life in general is that we are looking into these shadows on the wall, and we think that this is reality. We are so fixed into this. We are so, we have this habit, and this is all we know. But if we would dare to turn around, we would see the fire which causes the shadows on the wall, and then we could talk to the others of these things. Well, if you do that, people who are just looking at the shadows, they think you're nuts. They see you are insane, and they try to somehow label you as nutcase and put into minority and out of power. But the same idea, like trying to find like the ideas behind appearances, the deeper reality. It has taken different forms, that the basic idea, this, it's still there nowadays too in occult practices with all kinds of people and groups.
Yeah,
we go back to the basic ideas.
Right. Yeah. We always do. We always do, especially to reset. Vesa, I got to tell you, this has been a very enjoyable conversation. I've had a great time talking to you about this book. And this book, I encourage everyone to go out and get it. We have literally just scratched the surface of what is in this book. So many stories, so much great history, rich history, when it comes to Finland and everything that's in here. I encourage you, if you are any sort of fan whatsoever, having to do with the history of a rich history of the occult or the paranormal or anything just having to do with any subject. There's lots of stuff in here, folks. It's not just magic and the occult. There's parapsychology in here. There's UFOs in here. It's just got a rich history. Finland does. It's called Lightbringers of the North, Secrets of the Occult Tradition of Finland. Vesa Iitti. Close? Did I get close at the end there, Vesa?
It was very good. It was very good.
Oh, that which means thank you for
10 points.
10 points? Well, I appreciate that, Vesa. And Perttu Häkkinen.
Yes.
Perttu Häkkinen. There you go. Yeah. The writers of this book, the authors of this book, also an audiobook version as well. We'll have the link in the description of this show. Vesa, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Tim. It was a great honor being on your great podcast. Thank you.
Thank you so much. You know, we ran out of time yesterday before we were able to properly eulogize actress and singer Nichelle Nichols, probably best known for her portrayal of Lieutenant Uhura on Star Trek, the original series, and many of the Star Trek films that came from the original series. More than just Lieutenant Uhura, I think a lot of people don't know that. A lot of people think maybe she did the original series and then went away. Nichelle Nichols really was more than just that. She was more than just a bit player on a sci-fi series. And I'm sure you've heard the reports over many days since Nichelle Nichols' passing. She passed away at the age of 89 of natural causes, lived a good long life. But she also, after the series concluded, was key in recruiting for NASA and recruited many famous astronauts to NASA, which I believe our country is greatly indebted for. Nichelle Nichols was also an entertainer before she even got to Star Trek and had a four-octave voice, was performing in clubs in Chicago. And when Gene Roddenberry found her and she became an actress, which was the proper term at the time, we can call her an actor as she is, and came on board and did one series with her before she eventually did Star Trek. And interestingly enough, got to name her own character. I don't think a lot of people realize that Uhura is actually a spin or a softer version of the Swahili name Uhuru, which means freedom. And Gene Roddenberry thought that was a little harsh. It was a little bit of a harsh tone or a name for her character. And she said, well, you give it a go. So they softened it a little bit on the end and said Uhura. And Gene Roddenberry said, well, you know, it's yours. You named it. It's yours. And so she got to name her own character, which is unusual. And it started from there. She started breaking barriers from there. There was the first interracial kiss, as we know, or one of the first interracial kisses on TV with her and William Shatner. And, of course, just being one of the first African-American women on TV that wasn't playing a domestic worker or had a small role in the background. She was in the forefront along with the rest of the crew, and I think that was an important message, along with George Takei and with other minorities that were in the forefront working together as a team. Everyone emphasized everybody's strengths, and that was the great thing about Gene Roddenberry in that series. He emphasized that in the future, we all worked together. We all showed our strengths, and we minimized our weaknesses, and as a team, we overcame whatever odds were against us. And it was a beautiful message at the time. Such a beautiful message that when Nichelle Nichols decided she had had enough and she was going to walk off the set and she just was done playing the part, it was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. that came to her and said, "You can't," and I'm paraphrasing here, "you can't do that. Do you realize how many black children tune into Star Trek and see your face on that television and see a black woman of power on TV? You just can't do that. You don't realize what you mean to our community," which is incredibly powerful. Nichelle Nichols really was someone who pushed the boundaries, not just in sci-fi and not just in her area of acting, but really pushed the boundaries for human rights. And really, we tip our cap to her here at Darkness Radio, and we wish her Godspeed and good rest in the hereafter, and that we recognize her here and tip our cap to her, because she really led a life that we aspire to lead. And that you know, when you met her at a convention, she was kind to everyone, and she loved everyone. She was an admirer of you if you admired her. So that's what we strive to do here. And Godspeed, Nichelle Nichols, and you're loved and admired, and you'll be missed. Folks, want to remind you that it's been a little bit of a cold, dark world out there. And this weekend, as you head out there to do your thing, lighten it up for each other. Be kind to each other. Do something for one another. I want to remind you guys that, hey, you know what? We've had some tragedies here in the States, even though we took a bit of a worldview today. Do something for each other. You know, it's nice to send thoughts and prayers out to the people out in Eastern Kentucky who have been dealing with flooding issues. Do this weekend. Do more than just prayers and thoughts. Make a donation. Do whatever you can to physically help the people of Eastern Kentucky this weekend. The governor in Kentucky is saying that it's going to take up to a year to rebuild that area of Kentucky. There's 37 people at last count that are dead. There are hundreds that are missing. Do what you can to help out the National Guard there, the Red Cross, whoever's out there that's helping. You can do it just through an easy donation. Take your $5 you're going to use for a latte and throw that way so that there can be constant help to find those missing people, to help the people that still need help there, to help rebuild. There's still water falling. There's still rain out there in Eastern Kentucky. They're still in a crisis out there. There's people that need food and water. You can help. You can help make it easier to help the people that are still struggling out there. So do more than just thoughts and prayers this weekend. Take a little bit of your weekend. Help your fellow man out there. We all are in this with each other, and we're here to help each other. So please do more than just thoughts and prayers this weekend. Do it for your buddy Timmy and your buddies here at Darkness Radio. We appreciate it. So take care of yourself, take care of each other, have a great weekend, and we will see you on Tuesday for True Crime Tuesday here on the Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio.